Welcome to Brainstorm by Us Against Alzheimer's with our host, Merrill Comer. Merrill is a founding board member of Us Against Alzheimer's, a patient-centered nonprofit organization that has taken on the toughest problems in the fight against Alzheimer's disease. She is the author of the New York Times bestseller, Slow Dancing with a Stranger, which chronicles her journey as a caregiver for both her husband and her mother, who are living with Alzheimer's. Let's take a listen.
This is Brainstorm, and I'm Merrill Comer. The book is American Dementia, Brain Health in an Unhealthy Society. Our guest, Dr. Peter J. Whitehouse, professor of neurology at Case Western Reserve University and a professor of medicine at the University of Toronto. Also joining us, Daniel George, a medical anthropologist and associate professor in the Department of Humanities and the Department of Health Sciences at Penn State College of Medicine. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us. Dr. Whitehouse, Alzheimer's is today's most dreaded diagnosis. You suggest there's been a misunderstanding of the nature of the disease that leads to related errors. Where are we now in the science?
The science of Alzheimer's has become more complicated over the 50 years I've been involved in the field, to the point that I think one of the most important matters is to recognize that Alzheimer's is not one disease. It's a heterogeneous set of conditions or syndromes. There are hundreds of biological and clinical factors that affect how Alzheimer's disease manifests in the lives of the patients I cared for in your family. And so that's the watchword. The confusion, I think, also relates to how Alzheimer's disease relates to the aging changes that we all face to one degree or another. And so the idea that that simple cures, for example, the whole debacle about aducanumab's approval, an approval based on science that I think people were beginning to abandon until this medicine suddenly appeared in ways that surprised many of us.
Are we at a point where we are not curing disease, but simply managing it?
I think in the case of aducanumab, if you're building on that part of the conversation, we are actually not even clearly doing good based on the science that most people have been reviewed, and the FDA did make a mistake in approving it. But yes, the attempts are to move beyond symptomatic treatment, so people's memories are better, to attempt to slow the progression of disease. But I commend you for your own brain health work, because it seems to me the evidence is pretty clear that if we really do want to prevent age-related decline to a degree, I don't think we'll ever be able to prevent it altogether, we should focus on public health. We should focus on interventions that would benefit not only our brains, but our bodies and our entire societies.
Daniel, let's pick up on your concerns, the trusting market forces to win the battle. This paradigm has, and I'll quote, medicalized, monetized, and individualized brain aging. So my question to you is, what's the antidote?
Yeah, that's a great way of phrasing it. So the promise that we've been given since basically the 70s is that, you know, a combination of funding and time would unleash markets and biotechnology to lead to a cure. That unfortunately has not happened, even though we've spent billions of dollars and certainly expected that cure to come down the road. But what is the antidote? So the research is showing us that dementia rates, paradoxically, have been falling in the United States and in five other countries over the past decade. Now, why is that? As Peter is saying, it has to do with brain health across the lifespan. So when you look at all of these studies from these six countries, there are two key patterns. One, vascular health has dramatically improved for people who are now in their aging years, retirement years, and years of education has improved for the cohorts of current elders. So what have we done to improve vascular health? Well, after the crisis of the First and Second World War and the Great Depression, most countries implemented national healthcare systems that better treated hypertension and high cholesterol and diabetes, things that we know are risk factors for heart health, but also for brain health. We had very successful smoking cessation campaigns in the U.S. 44% of people smoked in the late 60s, and now it's down to about 14%. We were able to be a world leader in deleading gasoline through the EPA. That obviously removed a neurotoxin from our environments, but also a factor for that increases risk for heart disease. And then lastly, things like the GI Bill and other expansion of our education infrastructure increased access to education dramatically. 10 million World War II veterans, for instance, got college educations. Now, to your point, equity, and I'm so appreciative of the focus on that, that was not enjoyed universally in the culture because there was still segregation at colleges and universities in the United States in the mid-20th century. But the short answer to all of this is that the collective investments that we made in our people in the mid-20th century appear to have precipitated brain health benefit for current elders rather than the market.
What has COVID taught us both about the inequities and what we need to do? Because the issues of long COVID, brain fog, it's all coming to the fore again.
COVID has been a magnifying glass on some of these inequities that you both have been talking about and are so important. And I think nowhere better, unfortunately, can we see it than in long-term care and taking care of older folks who wish to stay in their homes or who wish to, who need to be in some kind of other residence. And I think behind COVID, there are other issues that we have to face as a world. The climate crisis, for example, COVID says that our relationships to nature are distorted. And I sometimes say the greatest threat to the quality of life for people with dementia is the climate crisis, because if you look at what's happening in New Orleans or with floods or fires, so we got to get our priorities right. There are so many things about brain health that are more important than purely looking at it as a brain issue. It's a social issue.
Let's explore that a bit more. And that whole issue, Daniel, of sort of monetizing brain health, brain games. We have a population that is terrified. And if you've seen the disease up close, you are front and center thinking this may happen to you.
That's right. And as you mentioned, there is a $1 billion marketplace of memory products. This encompasses nutrition supplements, video games, apps on phones, and it preys upon that fear that a lot of boomers have about brain aging. But increasingly, we're seeing the marketing directed towards millennials and Zoomers, people who compete in very competitive marketplaces where your cognitive functioning is very critical to your success. So what Peter and I try to do in the book is shift our understanding that brain health is something that we should think of at the individual consumer level, that we will sort of consume our way out of the problem, and think about, as we did in the mid-20th century, what sort of collective investments can we make as a people that will eventuate brain health for the most number of us? And that is things like increasing years of education for people once again through college and vocational training. It's extending healthcare to more and more people. We have 80 million un- and underinsured in this country. It means dealing with this crisis of lead that is affecting people of color in the inner cities disproportionately, but people all across the country, not just in Flint, Michigan, where it's been most dramatic. How do we think of brain health at the population level as something that we can move the needle on if we again invest in ourselves?
Danny and I are big advocates of education as a protective effect, just not education in a silly brain game way. Dan and I have both been involved in intergenerational public schools in Cleveland, where older people, some of whom have a dementia, some of my patients, came and volunteered and got benefit out of that, and obviously the kids benefit. So using your brain, really important, just using it for socially and individually meaningful purposes, including educating our future elders, our youngsters. And those intergenerational schools are in Cleveland, a city that is challenged by its public school system. Yes, keep our brains going, but use them for meaningful and purposeful activities. That's also fun, by the way. You can't just think of keeping your brain fit as something that's too serious.
There's another issue, how we have siloed disease. And that, to me, becomes an issue if we're moving toward prevention, where the heart becomes connected. How do we re-educate people about the connectivity and that wholeness that you describe from a social point of view?
Good point. The brain is a highly vascularized organ, and 20% of the heart's output goes to delivering oxygen and nutrients to it. So the fact that we've decoupled these organs that are intimately interwoven is kind of silly in a way, and a reflection of our sort of Western reductionist medicine. But not only are our bodies interconnected, we are members of families, of communities, of nations, and our fates are interdependent on one another. And so really trying to get away from this what Peter and I refer to as the neoliberal notion of the individual, the discrete individual. We're all units of one with our own sort of path. We need to think about our own collective destinies again. And that's something we have not been so good at doing over the last several decades.
50 million people have this disease worldwide. You have unpaid caregivers managing 75% of long-term care in this country, and we call them the invisible patient. Where have the greatest strides come from, in your opinion?
These age-associated cognitive challenges, these conditions that rob one's ability to make these connections with family and society, only emphasizes the importance of those connections in society. So I don't think the biology has given us much, and I think it's going to be limited even in the future, to be honest with you. But I do think that, for example, age-friendly communities, dementia-friendly communities, movements that essentially aging at home, livable communities, that's where the action is. It's also an action where you can bring in schools and museums and art and music, because it's all the things that animate ourselves as human beings that we ought to make sure that these people that we have a tendency to dehumanize and isolate, caregivers and patients, are just part of a human community that needs to strive in this time of social injustice and climate crisis together to address these problems in ways that don't silo the problems, just the way we silo organs, but bring the problems together and try to solve them collectively.
24 years ago, when my husband was misdiagnosed for 4 years, from everything from mad cow's disease to pernicious anemia, and then finally Alzheimer's, there was tremendous stigma around the disease. Now, with early diagnosis, are either one of you concerned that we are shifting the stigma early or in the disease so that we are in fact jeopardizing people in the earliest stages where they may still have much to contribute from a societal point of view?
As a clinician, of course, I'm quite aware of the power of labels, for good and for ill. And I was a critic of the whole labeling of mild cognitive impairment, because that is a heterogeneous set of conditions. And some people with mild cognitive impairment, in fact, get better. And a mild cognitive impairment can be caused by many factors. Now, the National Alzheimer's Association is promoting subjective cognitive decline. That's a label that you really only have to complain in order to get. You don't even have to show any abnormalities in test results. So I'm very concerned that eventually people will be labeled earlier and earlier and will spread the understandable anxiety to people that don't need to have that anxiety. And with biomarkers, that's to say the amyloid PET scanning that was unfortunately so important in the approval of aducanumab, it maybe will just be labeled by something they measure in our brains before we even have any perception there's something wrong. But the experts are labeling us as somebody with amyloid in the brain, which we know some people have and don't have dementia. So yes, absolutely. Meryl, I think that the misapplication of labels and the changing nature of labels, it's confusing to people and caregivers, and it's confusing because the experts are confused.
So, Daniel, are you concerned as a millennial that if you received an early diagnosis, you might be marginalized in the workplace? And how do we work against that from quickly becoming a reality?
I think we're in a service and knowledge economy, and your brain is sort of the muscle that you bring to the job. And so I think that's one thing that's getting preyed upon by this marketplace of memory products, for sure. But yeah, as a social scientist, I worry about the social death of dementia. The unpersoning of that label. And dementia-friendly communities, as Peter has invoked, is one way of mitigating that, training kids to recognize signs of memory loss, to normalize memory loss, to see that we all have some degree of memory loss. And the intergenerational school that Peter mentioned, which is where I did my doctoral research in Cleveland, people living with dementia, including early onset dementia, are considered mentors in the school rather than people with a disease. And I think that that is a really good microcosm of how we can shift the way that we orient people in the culture who may be struggling with some age-related memory challenges. We don't need to unperson them, and we should very much protect against that.
Dr. Whitehouse, on a personal note, I've cared for my husband, my mother with the disease. The last thing I want to do is shift that burden to my son and his family if I had the disease. What do you say to my generation, which I think, Dr. Whitehouse, is your generation, how we manage this?
When I reflect on my career, it started with my mother saying to me, as an MD PhD student at Hopkins, "Don't ever let me get like this," referring to her own mother. So yes, absolutely, the intergenerational responsibilities and duties are key. I would say though that America, as we say in American dementia, looks for quick fixes, magic bullets, silver bullets. It's not. If I were to say one thing to my grandkids, I have four of them, and to my kids, I would say, let's work together to make our whole society friendlier for people that have disabilities, have challenges, and let's embrace them. Let's not unperson them, as Danny said, or dehumanize them in the first place. So this is the problem of the medical model. It tends to, as you said, create a brain silo, a heart silo. We're not in silos. We are interconnected at our fundament. And this is a time for a declaration of interdependence. That's how we're going to address age-related cognitive challenges. That's where we're going to have to, how we're going to address some of the other social problems that we have.
Can I build on that, Meryl?
Certainly.
In preparation for this, I watched the PBS episode that featured you and your husband in 2006. It was very affecting, and it reminded me of the week that I spent caregiving for a great aunt in Cleveland before we got in-home care for her, and how difficult one week was. And so I think as we think about people with living with dementia, we also need to think about the caregivers and how can we support them as well. And as a millennial, you know, one thing that I look at is like Japan, for instance, and they have a national long-term care insurance program that everybody buys into, and it supports people living in institutional facilities. It supports in-home care. And when you think about like the headlines in the New York Times over the weekend were that the ways that corporations are finding ways, accounting tricks to stash their money in tax havens. The billionaires in our country have made over $1 trillion during COVID alone. And so when I hear that we can't pay for these kinds of things to support people like you, Meryl, and other caregivers, I just say, baloney, you know, we can figure this out, and we need to be talking about how to do it, not whether we can.
Well, insurers stopped writing long-term care policies a long time ago because it was the biggest payout. Their actuarial tables just didn't match up. Such a big issue and so little time. I want to fast forward with both of you. Daniel, first, what's the game changer in your mind and where we might be in 2025?
Peter and I both do question the idea of a fix. So I can't promise anybody a pharmacological game changer. I think that this may be a condition that we will never cure. However, I see those studies that I mentioned in Western countries, which show falling rates of dementia, as a roadmap for us. They very clearly show how very specific investments in population health and brain health can ramify over decades as gains in cognitive resilience for people. We need to get the lead out of our water. We need to make sure everybody has cradle-to-grave healthcare. We need to support caregivers. We need to make sure smoking rates stay down. And so, you know, for me, it's a question of how do we organize our society rather than how can we rely on markets to produce this fix. That's where I see hope, and that's where I'm going to be putting my focus and energy in the next decade.
Dr. Whitehouse?
I'm going to support Danny and other younger people because the future does belong to them, and I agree with what he just said. Thank you, and thank you, Meryl.
Our guests have been Dr. Peter Whitehouse and medical anthropologist Daniel George. The book is American Dementia, Brain Health in an Unhealthy Society. To learn more about your brain health, check out mybrainguide.org or the homepage at Us Against Alzheimer's. This is Brainstorm, and I'm Meryl Comer.
Support for Brainstorm by Us Against Alzheimer's comes from Karen and Chris Siegel, Biogen, and Esai. Subscribe to Brainstorm through your favorite podcast platform and join us for new episodes on the first and third Tuesday of every month.